So the title of tonight's talk is Observation, Investigation, and Response. And there's a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya about self-examination. And it basically says where the Buddha says that one who is not skilled in the ways of others' minds should train themselves to be skilled in the ways of their own minds. So if we want to understand the minds of other people, why they do what they do, what's going on there, the route to that understanding is to understand our own patterns, to understand our own minds. And how does one do this? The Buddha describes the method as being like a youth who is fond of ornaments and wants to look really nice, and so looks in the mirror to see, is the face clean? Or is there a smudge? Is there dirt? Is there blemish? Is there dust on the face? And if the youth finds that there is dirt on the face, then that youth makes an effort to wash it clean, to make an effort to remove it. But if the youth finds that the face is clean, then they're happy, they're glad that the face is free from dust and dirt and blemish. And he uses this simile to compare it to a monastic who is asked to look at the quality of their own minds and to see if their own mind is blemished, has dirt or dust or obscurations on it, or if their mind is clean. And then it gives a series of questions. And those questions include, there's 10 questions. I won't read all of them, but you'll get the idea pretty quickly. Am I often given to longing or often without longing? Am I often given to ill will or without ill will? Am I often overcome by dullness and drowsiness or free from dullness and drowsiness? Am I often restless or calm? Am I often plagued by doubts or free from doubts? Am I often agitated or unagitated, lazy or energetic, concentrated or unconcentrated, etc.? And then if one looks at the mind and finds that very often there are those defilements, there are what might be referred to as a blemish in the mind, then it's said that one should put forth extraordinary desire, effort, zeal, enthusiasm, indefatigability, mindfulness, and clear comprehension to abandon those unwholesome qualities. Just like somebody whose clothes or turban or hair was on fire would put forth extraordinary effort in order to extinguish that fire. In this way, with this kind of sense of urgency, you know, not just thinking, oh, I think I'll get around to that one of these days. Yeah, I got to work on that one, but not now. When your hair is on fire, you don't procrastinate. You don't put it off, and you don't get distracted by other things. There's only one thing that matters, and it's to extinguish those flames. And it's that kind of immediacy and urgency that he was suggesting that his monastics really work with any unwholesome state that they see arise in their minds. But if they look at their minds and they discover that their minds are not often defiled, then they should be happy and glad, and based upon those wholesome states, make the effort to reach awakening, to reach the destruction of the taints. And when I think about this little teaching, I think it kind of can fall into a three-step process. One observes what is occurring in the mind. One investigates what's going on to understand the patterns and the processes. And then one responds wisely, either by removing those unwholesome qualities or by using the stability of the wholesome state that is present in order to have further growth in the Dhamma. And I think this is a very common model for learning and for decision making. It doesn't appear particularly spiritual or religious. It's just a practical method for learning and responding to the conditions that we find in our lives. It doesn't need to have very specialized meditation techniques, and it doesn't have to follow a strict protocol for how to do it correctly. Instead, it's kind of a basic guideline to observe, to investigate, and to wisely respond, so that we look at our own minds and we see what's happening there. We understand how they work, and then, by extension, we'll be able to understand how others work. So our responses will not only be wise responses to the conditions of our own minds, but they will be wise responses in interactions and in community. So I want to first look at this, what I'm calling step one, which is observing, to, so to speak, look into the mirror. And mindful observation is basically a big chunk of what we're practicing here. We're learning to observe our experience with mindfulness. What is the state of your mind? What are you mindful of? What are you aware of? What's the quality of that knowing consciousness? What's the quality of the experience of awareness? Is your mind in a state that you would say is wholesome or unwholesome? Is it affected by greed, hate, and delusion, or unaffected by greed, hate, and delusion? And so we look into our own minds without expecting certain things, without demanding that we find only highly realized states, and without trying to conjure up signposts of success. We just simply look at the mind with curiosity and interest to know, what is the state of the mind right now? We're asking ourselves deeply, genuinely, how am I right now? It's a caring question. It's a loving question. If we expect something particular, though, then we might not notice what's actually there. We might be trying to conform to our expectation and put forth an image of ourselves to ourselves. With mindful observation, we're willing to see what's actually here. And so we cultivate a balanced attention, an interested attention, an attention that's willing to know the reality of what's actually occurring, because we want to understand what really is happening. And so we develop equanimity, a balanced mind, to be able to meet the variety of conditions that we find. And we look to see just what is happening, not what we want and desire, and not what we're afraid or are worried about, but are just what really is happening right now, in this present moment, in the quality of our own minds. So we observe the mind in the moment that it is knowing experience. So we don't just look at our minds and interpret it by the kind of personality we think we have and the tendencies that we know that we have, and say, my mind is always doing this. But in a moment of hearing, we look at the quality of mind that is knowing hearing. In the moment of feeling a sensation, we look at the quality of mind that is knowing that sensation. In the moment of meeting a thought and recognizing that thought, we look at the quality of the mind that is thinking. We turn our attention away from the assumptions, away from the external object, away from the personal story, to consider what is the quality of mind that is knowing. Sure, some attention can be paid to the content. So we can get some clues, some hints about the state of mind by seeing the content of the thoughts. But primarily we're looking to the quality of the mind itself, the quality of the knowing. Is there agitation? Is there ill will? Is there fear? Is there longing? Is there worry? Is there lust? Or is there calmness? Is there equanimity? Is there curiosity, appreciation? Is the mind concentrated? Is there joy? What is the state of our minds? What is the quality of the knowing? And so we actively inquire, we frequently look to see what the quality of our awareness is. Is our attention affected by defilements, by hindrances? Or is our mind concentrated? Is it steady? Is it stable? Is it scattered? Is it sluggish? Is it energetic? Are hindrances present, or are the awakening factors developing? Usually we can't do very much about what the object is that's being known. Sometimes there's a loud sound and our attention is drawn to the hearing, and sometimes there's a sensation in the body. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. And we can just know that. Sounds, sights, sensations, thoughts, they arise due to conditions, and very often those conditions are beyond what we can control. But we can work with how we relate to whatever that stimulus is that is being known. We can look to see if we're relating to it in a way that is activating the defilements, or if we're meeting that experience with wisdom and with equanimity. Skilled meditators learned to develop an even observing attitude that is just as willing to observe the pleasant experience as the unpleasant or the neutral experience. We develop a capacity to have an honest, straightforward observation of what's actually happening, because this straightforwardness allows us to gather information, and we want the information we gather to be as accurate as possible. Sure, it's going to be filtered by our perceptions, which are faulty, but we can try to make it with as little fault as possible, so we can see as clearly as possible how is the mind functioning, what are its habits. If the mind is often affected by greed or aversion, then that will be affecting our attention, and whatever information we gather will be slanted and distorted. Often I come back to the same question again and again, tens of thousands of times, hundreds of thousands of times, and it's simply, what's happening now? What's happening now? What's being known right now? And what is the quality of the mind that is knowing it? Is there a particular attitude that is informing the observation? When experiencing any of the sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thought, we can bring this unbiased, mindful observation to know that experience. We don't have to know the experiences of the senses filtered through desire and aversion. We don't have to know them filtered through the delusion of assessing what's to self-advantage, what's going to boost me, you know. But we can look at our sensory experience and bring this even, unbiased quality that is so intimately associated with mindfulness. When we're walking, we can feel the sensations of walking. We can know that. When we're eating, we can observe the experience of taste and texture and the qualities in the chewing. We can observe how we interact, how we speak, how we listen in the small groups and the question and answer sessions. We can sustain a mindful awareness of our encounter with every moment, from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep. We can be mindful of anything that we feel, anything that we perceive, anything that we know. And we can be mindful of the quality of that knowing. Some people forget to be mindful of seeing. You saw things today. Were you mindful of seeing? If something caught your attention and you turned your head to look at it, maybe it was one of those very beautiful purple flowers out there. Were you mindful? Were you aware that your attention was caught and that you were looking? Maybe there was a bird that flew by and you went and looked. We can be mindful of that. It's not wrong to look. We have eyes. They see. But let's bring awareness and mindfulness to that too. What catches our attention and how are we meeting it? How is that affecting our moods and our emotions? What's our response to what we see? This practice of observing is the essence of mindfulness training. But we don't just stop with observing. We next investigate. An investigation can involve a kind of contemplation. We might examine our experience. We might even pose questions. This is a learning phase that puts the information that we gathered from the observation into coherent and meaningful patterns so that we can apply them for useful purposes. This is the development of wisdom. Because otherwise, we might just all go about seeing and hearing and tasting and feeling and sensing and sensing and sensing, but not be able to really distinguish what's significant in that. But in the approach we've been working with on this retreat, we began with wisdom. The first instruction assumed you already had enough wisdom to discern what was skillful, what was unskillful, what was wholesome, what was unwholesome. We began with that. We looked at our thoughts and put them in two piles. We brought forth the wisdom that we already have and then built our mindfulness, built our attention upon that wisdom, refining it, investigating our experiences with more detail and more clarity. So we investigate so that we can understand the patterns and relationships that develop in the way we encounter any perception. We investigate so that we can recognize what the causes and the effects are of any action or any engagement. We recognize what is significant about events. In particular, where does it lead? Where do things lead? Are they leading to harm and affliction and suffering? Or are they leading to clarity towards love, towards compassion, and towards freedom and letting go? We understand, we learn so that we understand how the mind functions in a moment of contact, in a moment of knowing. So we explore, we investigate causes, effects, relationships, functions with enough curiosity to learn about this moment of encounter, this moment of contact. How did that perception occur, we might wonder? What preceded it? What did it come out of? And what followed it? Things don't arise out of nothing. They're embedded in experience. There was a previous moment and there was a subsequent moment. How does what's happening now relate to what happened a moment before and a moment after? When we look at what's happening now, we can ask ourselves, well, what is going on in this state? What are the kinds of qualities, what are the kinds of functions and factors that seem to always arise together? And what never arises together? We are curious to understand perception. And not just perception, but every aspect of the mind. How does volition, intention, operate? How does it function? How does attention work? What feelings are present? How do they change? So when we're investigating our experience, we're looking at more than just one aspect that we identify. Oh, this is happening. Because the this is just a brief concept to identify and label the experience, to meet it. But when we look more closely at whatever this is, a moment of hearing, we'll realize that there isn't just an external object, there's an internal sensitivity. There's consciousness oriented towards the ear door. There's feeling, there's perception, there's volition. There's a quality of attention. There might be defilements of greed or of hate. There might be the opposite, non-greed, non-hate. There might be beautiful qualities of mind, of mindfulness and of faith. There might be an active directing of attention and sustaining of attention. There might be joy or not. There might be equanimity or not. There might be sloth and torpor or not. There might be wisdom or not. So we can look and see a lot of variety of factors go into the moment of knowing hearing. So now we're really engaged more in the details and dynamics of what's happening in a moment of knowing. We're learning about the process. So we're not merely settling the mind on a single perception to develop a smooth, calm, concentrated state. And we're not merely accepting things as they occur, but allowing the patterns to roll on, assuming we're being mindful because we're sort of aware of what's happening now. We're looking more closely to really understand how the mind is working so that we will be able to more skillfully guide its development on this liberating path. This is a mode of engagement that leads to the end of suffering. So we're engaged in the development of our practice. We're engaged in the development of our minds. Curiosity is a tremendous aid for this kind of investigation. Sometimes I find when we don't understand something that it can be very engaging. It can be very stimulating. It can be rather exciting to perhaps read a sutta and not understand what the Buddha meant. Those are the most exciting suttas. If we read it and we go, yeah, got it, knew it already. Where's the excitement and learning in that? But when we read a sutta or hear a Dharma talk or experience some little flicker of something in our minds and we don't really know what it is, to me, that's when the meditation gets interesting. That's when there's some excitement to want to explore it, to want to understand. And there's kind of joy and a sense of being energized, fired up to look more closely, to really investigate it. Maybe to sit with it. That's one of the best ways of investigating, is to just sit with it, to bring it into the meditation in the sense of allowing. We can't make it happen again. We can't force something that we read in a book to appear in our meditation. But we can quiet the mind. We can calm the mind. And then we can perhaps bring in a little simple thought or reflection that might allow some degree of exploration to see if we can find that experience or that teaching in our experience. So we're not doing an intellectual kind of comparing of this teaching with that teaching. We might read something about the way that there's pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings and the way that the mind works with those. And so we come in and we sit and we just are curious about feeling and we have a thought, well, what's the feeling? And what is the feeling in this and how is it operating? And we really look carefully, closely. I've really enjoyed the richness of the Buddhist psychology of called Abhidhamma to explore the mind with this kind of investigative interest, because the Abhidhamma offers a certain structure. It offers a certain model that includes a variety of categories and lists that can create a framework for investigation. And then they've carefully analyzed how different cognitive processes operate. And it's very interesting to have meditated for a while and looked at my own mind and then read some Abhidhamma and seen, well, I wonder if that's true. It's maybe a different model. So, for example, there's 52 mental factors that are organized into different groups and clusters based upon wholesome and unwholesome states. So, one of the things that it says about the state of anger is that the feeling tone, there's a feeling tone in every state, but the feeling tone in a state of anger is always unpleasant. It's never pleasant. Now, I agreed with this because every time in my own practice I had looked at anger, I always felt this is dukkha, obviously. This is painful. This is unpleasant. This is the Vedana of it was always unpleasant for me. So I didn't have any trouble with this, except many students would say, no, anger is pleasant. Anger is really pleasant. So what's going on there? So I looked really carefully. Well, what is going on there? And I think after a moment of anger, very often it's followed by a moment of conceit, a sense of I, a sense of self. And guess what? Conceit is very often pleasant. So we can often confuse conceit and anger, conceit and anger. And if we hone in on and tune in to the Vedana, the feeling tone, the pleasantness and the unpleasantness, it might help us discern the difference and the way and see the way that conceit and anger fuel each other. But you shouldn't believe the Abhidhamma, and you don't need to believe me. Look in your own experience and see what you find. Another statement that was in the Abhidhamma was that mindfulness only arises in wholesome states. It can never arise in an unwholesome state. Do you find this to be true in your experience? What many people say is, that can't be true because I'm mindful of the hindrances. Even in the Satipatthana teachings, it says to be mindful of the hindrances, right? If you go to a teacher and you say that you're angry, they say, have you been mindful of it? If you're experiencing craving, be mindful of it. So how can there not be mindfulness and a wholesome state? But I think this is a very interesting question. How do you distinguish mindfulness from attention? How do you distinguish mindfulness from concentration, from the application of the mind to the object? We use these words as though they're something fixed and we know what they mean. But maybe we're using the words sometimes to mean different things. And so we have to look really closely. What would the Abhidhamma be meaning? What is that quality that they're saying is mindfulness that can only arise in wholesome states? What is that particular special kind of attention that is always associated with faith and with goodwill and with a malleability and an uprightness of the mind and is never found with anger or lust or delusion or restlessness? And so we look. So we look at different qualities of attention until we see, oh, that quality of attention, maybe we called it all attention, but that might be what the Abhidhamma was describing as mindfulness, because we find that that quality of attention never arises in an unwholesome state. Also, it says that delusion is present in every unwholesome state, and restlessness is present in every unwholesome state. That every moment of desire and aversion, there is restlessness and delusion. So if you get tired of watching desire and aversion, but they haven't gone away, well, look for the delusion in it. Look for the restlessness in it and see if it's there. It gives you something else to investigate. So you see those states from different directions. You see what they depend upon because they have to come together as units or as groups. As you cultivate concentration, we can look also at the qualities that must be present in a concentrated state. So for example, when the mind is concentrated, when there is a state of samadhi, there are no hindrances. How does mindfulness function in a state of samadhi? It's very interesting to watch how attention functions, how volition, intention, attention and intention and concentration function. Is joy always present in a concentrated state? Is joy present in a mindful state? Can joy and equanimity arise together? If so, what is the quality of equanimity that can arise as an awakening factor, and how is that different than the quality of equanimity that might be considered the equanimous feeling, a neutral feeling, or the equanimity that arises as a Brahma-vihara, equanimity towards all beings, or that quality of a balanced state that is a component of all wholesome qualities, all wholesome states. In English, there's actually a few different Pali words, but they're all translated as equanimity. So what are those different states? Even when we don't have a different word for them, can we recognize those states, those factors, those qualities? Or maybe they're all functions, might be a better way of seeing them, functions of mind. Do greed and hate ever arise together? The Abhidhamma says no. Greed might lead to hate, hate might lead to greed. They might flop back and forth, flitter back and forth, but they never co-arise. And sloth can never arise along with wisdom. Sloth and torpor don't arise with wisdom. And mindfulness doesn't arise with lust. And lust doesn't arise with the uprightness and the malleability of the mind. So, if we pick up a model, and this is just an Abhidhamma model, you can pick up any question that you hear, anything that you're curious to investigate. It doesn't have to be a 2,000-year-old model. But we investigate. We're curious about something. And in order to investigate, we have to let go of what we assume that we'll find. We have to let go of our expectations as much as possible, so that we can allow some space to investigate our own experience and then to consider the terms that we've picked up from this model as a way of seeing our own experience from another viewpoint, from another direction, from something that's not been habitual to us. We can let wisdom develop out of honestly investigating our own minds and stay vigilant for the ways that our habitual interpretations, our stories, our delusions feed the construction of self and the distorted perceptions of our own experience. We can appreciate whatever clarity we have, whatever degree of insight we might have, and experience that with joy. There's nothing wrong with enjoying our meditation practice. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the exploration of our own minds. I personally enjoy working with various systems and different models. I like picking up suttas that have various lists, and sometimes I'll be very comfortable with a few items in the list, and then not so comfortable with some of the other items in the list. So I can use the strength that I can enter into the ones that I've already worked with and already developed, starting there, and then see how does that teaching expand out to include the other items in that list. One of the things that has interested me so much about these teachings that we're working with on overcoming distracting thoughts and removing those distracting thoughts is that I had read the sutta so many times and now and then would apply them very specifically. I actually consider them sort of all come embedded in a general meditation practice, that we do them. But when I parsed them out as separate steps, they became very, even more interesting to me. I could see how different moments were, different degrees of energy were needed for different strategies. Different situations were affected differently by the different strategies. And I also found that using it as an investigation of mind led so clearly to an unraveling of not just the coarse, unwholesome thoughts that obsess our thinking, but we get down to see what is the main thought the main problem. What is the problem that pervades, or the thought that pervades or initiates the majority of our unwholesome thoughts? It's the thought of who I am. It's that self-constructing. And so this whole practice can be a practice that leads to understanding the emptiness of self. So what is a wise response? So I spoke of observation and investigation. The third stage is the wise response. So once we've observed and investigated our experience, then we have to respond. And sometimes that response is just another moment of mindfulness, that no action beyond that mental application of mindfulness or that receiving of the moment is needed. But sometimes it feels like a more active response is needed. So we have to consider, what do we do and what do we not do? And how do we decide whether something should be done or not? Wisdom implies that we act in ways that weaken the defilements and strengthen the wholesome states. That's the essence of wisdom. Weakens the defilements and strengthens the wholesome states. We can act in many ways. We can act with our body, we can act with our speech, and we can act with our minds through the way that we apply our attention, what we develop within our minds, and the way that we think and feel. We can make adjustments to our behavior, we can make adjustments to our patterns of speech, and we can make adjustments to our attitudes and our mental patterns, our ways of thinking. We can learn to take more skillful courses of action in all these areas of body, of speech, and of mind. And once we make an action, take an action, then what? We then observe and we investigate, and if needed, we refine our response. We adjust our action. And we're always doing this when we're meditating. We're making little adjustments to our effort. We're reminding ourselves to connect with the experience as it is. We're curious, so we observe, we investigate, and we respond with a different quality or a more nuanced, subtle way of meeting that experience. If there's an unwholesome intention in the mind, if there's an unwholesome pattern, then we probably want to do something about it. We probably want to respond very diligently, like in the sutta, the monks were encouraged to respond with the urgency as though one's hair was on fire. But often our states are not extremely unwholesome, they're just mildly so. Like, what about pain? We experience discomfort in the body, we experience physical pain. We also experience grief and emotional pain. What would be a wise way of working with pain? It might be simply to be able to give our attention to the pain and to know it. To really know it, to really embrace it, to recognize that it's happening and to allow it to happen. Can we allow the space in our lives for the fact of unpleasant things to happen? They do anyway. So maybe we should stop resisting it. Maybe that would reduce a bit of friction. And then we meet it. we really observe that experience of unpleasantness. If it's a bodily pain, we might want to see it as sensations that are unpleasant, changing sensations. And as we observe it, we have to also watch how we're relating to it. How is it being known? Are we relating through a story? Are we relating through fear? We can check our reactions of mind, and that is where we can adjust. That is where we can adjust our action, our mental action, so that we can observe it in a way that allows the experience to be known as it is, to allow it to unfold with a mind that is at ease and that is spacious in the experience. So we watch the sensations, yes, and we also watch our mental reactions. But when we're working with pain, it's important that we not fatigue ourselves. Working with a lot of pain can be very exhausting, whether that's physical pain or emotional pain. And so it's very helpful to, before diving into the depths of our pain, that we first cultivate kind of a resting place. It could be some comfort in the posture. It could be a simple touch of where our hands touch our legs, feels kind of pleasant or easy for the attention to rest on. Or it could be the attention to the breath or to the sounds arising and passing. There isn't one right object, but I think before we go into the depths of emotional or physical pain, before we really give full attention to it, I think we have to have a place that we can come back to and know our way back to that very simple experience of feeling the hands on the thighs or feeling the in-breath and the out-breath. Because then when we have that kind of strength and that place to rest in a very simple but, you know, stabilizing way, then we can rest our attention there and then work with the pain and then come back. Then we won't get sucked, we won't get stuck in it, and we won't be exhausted by it. We'll have the energy to be able to move back and forth between a more easeful place and a more painful observation. One of the most important things in working with pain is to have a skillful attitude towards it, to understand that pain is a Dhamma object. It's how things are. And it is an opportunity to actually know the first noble truth, that conditioned phenomena is unsatisfactory. When we really know that what we're investigating is one of the noble truths, then aversion to the pain falls away. And we are, I hate to say it, but happy to explore it, happy to know it. Because we know that our exploration is held within a context of this path. The exploration is not increasing the dukkha. The exploration is helping us to understand the dukkha so that we can discover the release from dukkha. We're basically meeting it with wisdom. We're understanding how the mind is involved in the pain, how the mind is knowing the pain, is interpreting the pain, is engaging with the pain, and is responding to the pain. And we're inclining towards a wise response by seeing, is our way of knowing, is our way of interpreting, is our way of engaging with this difficult situation, is it helping or is it hurting? Is it increasing defilements or is it bringing more letting go, more peace, more understanding, more calm, more equanimity? It's not about whether it's more pleasant or unpleasant. That's not the scale. The scale is the wholesome and the unwholesome. So we have an unbiased attention as the foundation of our mindfulness practice. And when mindfulness is established, then any effort, any action that we may take will be based upon the wholesomeness of our mindful attention. Even effort that is applied to desire and aversion, if effort is just applied to, and we to desire and aversion without becoming mindful of the desire and aversion first, then we're going to just be fueling desire and aversion. We're just going to be giving energy to the desire and giving energy to the aversion. We'll be enhancing the defilements. But if we can get a moment of mindfulness, a moment of unbiased, clear observation of what is actually happening, and see it with wisdom, enough wisdom to recognize that it is an unwholesome state, that's just enough mindfulness that the mindfulness will replace the deluded state, and then our observation will be clear, and the mind will be balanced, and we'll be able to see what's actually happening without fueling unwholesome states. Then the kinds of actions that are needed are usually very subtle, minor adjustments to our energy or mind, or subtle adjustments to our attitude. For mindfulness to really be the mindfulness that's spoken of in the Abhidhamma, for mindfulness to really be right mindfulness in the Eightfold Path, it has to be supported by other factors. There'll be times when our mindfulness will need a real boost of energy, or will lead to renunciation, or resolve, or faith, or fortitude, or patience. Especially when conditions are painful or difficult, we'll probably need some resolve and determination, some fortitude and energy to work with it. Like in the sutta, if your mind is overrun with unwholesome states, then you can resolve to abandon them as earnestly and as diligently as someone whose hair is on fire would strive to extinguish those flames. And when conditions are good and the mind is relatively balanced and pure, you don't become complacent. You don't just sit back and enjoy the comfort of that relatively pure mind. You recognize there's good conditions now. The mind is in a wholesome state. Mindfulness is present. There's some degree of calmness, tranquility, concentration. And so we use that energetically for the further development of wholesome state. And so this is the path, abandoning the unwholesome and cultivating the wholesome. And so we observe, we investigate, and we respond. So we'll have a few quiet minutes of meditation. And then I won't ring the bell. I would ask that you sit for at least a couple of minutes, just out of respect for the, you know, the teachings, allow them to settle. And then continue to practice this evening as long as you wish. You can do some walking, you can do some longer sittings, but I would encourage you to really use the evening fully. And don't go to bed until you're really tired or you feel like you're really ready to sleep. If you have the energy, this is the time to use it, to really use it for practice. If you feel more comfortable to stand out under a tree or sit under a tree or sit on a chair out there, great, do so. Find a way to practice just in your own way as fully as possible tonight.